This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we commemorate the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City and the Pentagon forever altered both the course of American foreign and domestic policy. In the aftermath of 9/11, President George W. Bush signed the Patriot Act, which was renewed in 2011 by President Barack Obama. The government also expanded the ability of the National Security Agency to collect data on U.S. citizens, foreign nationals, and governments. Then, former President Bush launched a war against the Taliban in Afghanistan, who harbored al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden, who was later killed in a raid by U.S. special forces in Pakistan in 2011 under orders from President Obama. Despite bin Laden's death, the beefing up of homeland security and other precautions taken since 9/11, we have witnessed a proliferation of less spectacular but no less serious threats to innocents around the world. Al-Qaeda affiliates in North Africa and Yemen are strong. The growth of the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL or Daesh, in Iraq and Syria, is responsible for carnage and chaos from the Middle East to France. ISIS-inspired attacks have occurred from San Bernardino, California, to Bangladesh. We also have lone wolves with whom to contend, many of whom are radicalized by the Internet. Well, with us to discuss the fight against terrorism on this anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks on U.S. soil are Thomas Sanderson. He's a senior fellow and director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a think tank here in Washington. And Nadia Owaidat. She's Middle East fellow at New America, also a foundation based here in Washington. And she's currently working on a book on social media and positive change among Arabic speakers. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Well, Thomas Sanderson, let me begin with you. So 15 years out from the worst terror attack on U.S. soil, how would you assess the threats to the U.S. homeland today?
To the homeland, they remain quite significant, primarily because the call has gone out from both al-Qaeda and from ISIS to attack in place. For individuals who have never set foot anywhere in the battle space outside of this country to take up arms any way that they can to strike at the head of the snake, to strike the country that is leading the counter-ISIS or counter-Al-Qaeda, counter-jihadist coalition worldwide. And so we remain the number one target. We are quite some distance from the core competencies and center of gravity for both ISIS and al-Qaeda. But by being able to reach out so easily through social media and by reaching disaffected individuals or by radicalizing individuals who may not be disaffected, they are able to put the nation under some degree of threat by reaching these people who can quite simply procure a weapon, make their own bomb, and attack wherever they choose.
And Nadia Owaidat, how do you see the threat to especially the U.S. homeland today compared to 15 years ago?
Well, I'm going to look at it differently from my colleague here. Unfortunately, we have done very little to undermine the ideology that continues to attract people under whatever name, whether it's al-Qaeda, ISIS, Fatah al-Sham, whatever name the terrorist group is. We have done very little since 9/11 to really undermine this ideology and to deconstruct it and eliminate it. So this is where the challenge is. And unless we go at the ideology, we will continue to just fight the next batch of recruits. And one reason why we have not is because we're much more comfortable with the security side of things. So we have really beefed up that side. We have quadrupled spending. How much have we done in actually creating different ideas? Like, I can't tell you how many former extremists I've interviewed who read a philosophy book for the purpose of undermining and ridiculing Western philosophy, only to be converted to humanism because they got infected with the bug of critical thinking, of seeing different perspective, which many communities, many schools do not really equip students to have that. Quite the opposite. If you grew up in many Muslim communities, you are encouraged to do rote memorization. You are punished if you ask questions. So it's a whole different way of education, right? Philosophy is questioning. So there are a lot of things that we haven't even started to undermine Islamist fanaticism.
Turning back to you, Thomas Anderson, Nadia brings up a very good point that we've thrown a lot of money on military or combating terrorism through the military. We have a large Homeland Security bureaucracy, which is very important, but perhaps just not sufficient.
Well, you could say that both, that all elements are not sufficient. We certainly have increased security. Now, some people may not feel comfortable with that, but we definitely have increased security, yet the threats have increased as well. But let me say something in support of Nadia's comment. 10 years ago, on the fifth anniversary, my colleague Julie Smith and I and our other colleagues at CSIS did an assessment across six different elements of the challenge of terrorism. One of them was ideology and the battle of ideas, and we listed four accomplishments and six continuing challenges. Among those continuing challenges 10 years ago was the failure to create a counter-narrative to global radicalism, and that remains today. Among that category as well was U.S. moral authority and image eroded by Guantanamo, fortress mentality at embassies stifle public access and outreach, and democracy and development assistance agendas viewed skeptically in many countries. We have those problems today. A lot of work has been done on those, and certainly progress has been made, but we still are in a position where those are not at the level that they need to be in order to be successful. But back to your main question, on the military side, we have spent a tremendous amount, and we have honed our military tools to quite a degree, and they are incredibly effective on the kinetic end of counterterrorism. That is just one piece of the pie, though. There are many other elements we have to do, from the public diplomacy, the counter-ideology, the development assistance. There are a lot of areas that remain weak. They are not popular with members of Congress because they don't result in weapons being produced in their districts. It also seems too soft for many members of Congress. They don't seem to offer tangible results or immediate results. And this is a problem, and we will continue to face it, and that will be continued to be exploited by our adversaries.
Turning back to you, Nadia Awad, that you have your finger on the pulse of the Arab world. And I've heard said that many analysts and people in the Middle East are concerned about the U.S. role in the world and perhaps not doing enough. And I'm referring in particular to Syria, because the Syrian civil war has spawned now the most severe refugee crisis since World War II. And particularly in Europe, you have many fleeing the depredations of the Bashar al-Assad regime. And we have fresh evidence that Assad, this is a president of a country, so we're not talking about non-state sponsors of terror as we have been with al-Qaeda or ISIS, but a president of a country who many have said, as has President Obama, lost his legitimacy, but he's still there, backed by the hilt by another state, Russia, another state, Iran. So to what extent do you think the continuation of this conflict continues to fuel disenchantment, incredible despair that feeds into extremism, violent extremism?
You know, this is such a great point. And at the core of the challenges coming out of the Middle East, whether it's the ideologies, it's the conflicts, at the core of all these challenges is that we have governments that are incapable of governing or that are really disadvantaging their populations. They are producing to the world the highest unemployment rate. They're producing to the world millions upon millions of uneducated young people who are unable to participate in their own economies or the global economy. So these governments are at the core of a lot of these challenges. And unless we really emphasize that all aid, and we give a lot of it to a lot of authoritarian regimes, but unless we insist that all aid must be contingent upon reform, and not reform rhetorically, but actual reform, deliverable reform, there's no way anything will change, and things will continue to go bad to worse, as they have.
Well, that's a very good point. But to what extent the actual conflict in Syria, and we're talking about a lost generation of children, not only are they being inculcated, but they're not even being educated at all. So we are probably seeing the roots of more terrorism. But the fact that this conflict by a minority Alawite regime, which allies itself with the Shia-dominated Iran, which is also backed by Russia, to what extent do you think this fuels more Sunni extremist groups, since to Bashar al-Assad, all mainstream opposition to Bashar al-Assad, you know, is being whittled away. There's nothing in the middle. So they either cede somehow to the Bashar al-Assad regime or are wooed by the likes of Jabhat Fateh al-Sham or ISIS.
So the conflict in Syria is very similar to the conflict that existed in Afghanistan. It's a proxy war between states, really, with a lot of fighters on the ground acting for one state or another, be it Russia and Iran and the Syrian regime or Saudi, the Gulf states. And we really do have to be careful, because unless we invest in these civilians, millions of them, as you mentioned, we have the recruits for the next generation. We ignored what happened after the conflict in Afghanistan, and we had civil war in Algeria. We had a lot of terrorist attacks in Egypt. We had a lot of those who fought in Afghanistan coming to Iraq and then playing a role in also destabilizing Syria. So once you create a lot of young men who are used to carrying guns and killing and maiming, they don't know anything else. They're traumatized. And they also have gotten used to this way of life. And they are depriving children from going to school and maybe even worse, indoctrinating them. So you are really seeing the conflict having phenomenal potential to exacerbate and threaten the world order that much more.
What about, from your perspective, Thomas Anderson, with all the money being thrown again from the military perspective, and as you said, being very effective in the apparatus of Homeland Security, whether here in the United States or elsewhere, better intelligence sharing, are we, in a sense, offsetting all that good by not dealing with another crisis that is the Syrian civil war and the kind of extremism it is spawning by none other than actually, you know, states who are sponsoring the terror, whether it's Bashar al-Assad, the regime of Vladimir Putin, or Iran?
That's an excellent question. Let me first note, apart from Iranian support and Russian support, Assad also has the support of Hezbollah, Shiite militia from Lebanon. So a very important component to his strength. If not for Putin's intervention last year, Assad would be cooling his heels if he had survived somewhere inside Russia or elsewhere. So he would not be in place but for Russia's intervention. Certainly Hezbollah and Iran would have redoubled efforts, but he was on the ropes. His skin was saved by the Russians and a combination of Hezbollah and Iran. Let me first state, with regard to not providing as much as we could for the fight in Syria, by noting that there are no good plan A's out there, or plans A, and there are certainly oftentimes no plan B. So the president has decided not to be deeply involved in Syria for some very good reasons. Nonetheless, a more concerted effort would have probably solved some problems, but could have potentially generated even greater problems. But today, you are in fact right that we have a dictator who's in place who is a magnet for Sunni fighters from around the world. More than 40,000 foreign fighters from more than 120 countries have made the trip to Syria and to Iraq to fight against Shia forces, to fight against the Assad regime, to fight against the Iraqi regime, and to fight against the small but important number of coalition forces that are in place there. I see this continuing for quite some time. The tremendous suffering that we've seen is going to continue for some time. There is not a good solution on the horizon. By not supporting the moderate fighters, we essentially lengthen the spectrum between Assad on one end and those Sunni fighters who are facing them on the other. And then those are the much more extreme, more effective fighters that you find in Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, the former Nusra Front, with Arar al-Sham, Sukr al-Sham, and of course with ISIS. So today we have this polarization of the battlefield. And if you join up today, you're joining up to join one of the more extreme groups and not the middle group that failed to garner a lot of support from the U.S.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Nadia Owedat, she's Middle East Fellow at New America, that's a think tank here in Washington, and Thomas Sanderson, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're discussing the continuing fight against terrorism on this 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castillo VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Emmanuel Nwagwugwu from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Again, if you want to hear your name on the show, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, quickly back to you, Thomas Sanderson, to take a look at some of the remaining challenges. We've already mentioned many, but what about the strength of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, for example, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where this whole threat began for us more than 15 years ago? How have we been able to thwart the threat? It seems as if it's growing.
The threat is growing worldwide. You point to Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Al-Qaeda threat there. That is where the center of gravity is in terms of the leadership with Ayman al-Zawahiri. However, the more potent components of Al-Qaeda are outside of that region. It does remain a threat in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We have a very limited number of forces there. The Afghan security forces are effective in certain ways, but it goes way beyond that. It's the environment in which these groups operate, where there's very little economic development, where there is radicalization, there's very little education. There's a lot of underlying causes, demographic issues that feed into this. But to continue on your question on the threat from Al-Qaeda, you saw in the last several months attacks across West Africa in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. You saw it in Bamako, in Mali at the hotel. You saw it in Cote d'Ivoire. Now, this is Al-Qaeda, I think, trying to provide demonstrations of relevancy in the face of ISIS capturing all the headlines across the world. And I think we'll continue to see more attacks like that. And in Yemen, of course, you have AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the most effective group and affiliate of Al-Qaeda, I believe, in its ability to threaten the U.S. homeland and to threaten other regions around the world. And they operate from somewhat of a safe haven. There may be no government there to threaten them, but there are many other groups there. They are more powerful in Yemen than ISIS, but they have to deal with Houthi rebels and lots of other folks with which they are engaging. So the Al-Qaeda network is alive and well. Of course, their affiliate in Syria, the Nusra Front, recently renamed to Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, is very powerful and very clever. And they have tremendous legitimacy and credibility among Syrians because they are a largely Syrian group. They are taking the battle to Assad's forces, to Hezbollah, to the Russians, and to the Iranians and their Revolutionary Guards, Quds Force that's operating there. So there's a lot of legitimacy and a lot of credibility among populations around the world that are drawn to this battle for Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
Well, Nadia Awad, that again back to you regarding to what do you attribute this proliferation of terrorist groups that seem to still attract support, for example, in Syria? How did we get to this point where we don't have a middle ground? Is it a failure of leadership on the part of the West? How do you see this?
There has been an increasing polarization in the Middle East, but also in the world. But if you look at the Middle East, there's actually a phenomenal opportunity that we can tap into to really take on this problem at its roots. We cannot manufacture a narrative for these local communities and tell them, hey, this is what you think. But we can empower, listen to, aid in any way we can, local voices, creative activists, scholars whose entire life is dedicated to countering this ideology. You know, I meet a lot of these creative people. They are so inspiring. I interviewed one last week who created content for children because he didn't want his children to learn to hate from infancy.
Where was he from?
He is Jordanian, living in Dubai. And basically, his kids were watching Al Jazeera for children, and he noticed that they were basically educating the kids that as Muslims, we are superior. It's really a form of fascism. And he didn't want his kids to grow up hating. So he literally quit his job and started writing children's stories that really help kids develop critical thinking, appreciation for the universal values of human rights, curiosity about the other, about the world, different races, different peoples. And his stories are now being read a million times a month. So what if we put this amazing resource at the hands of the Syrian kids, as opposed to allowing some Saudi educational parties that produced for us the Taliban generation to educate them to be the next recruits of whatever terrorist group of the day we're fighting. But we can stand firmly behind our values. And this is what these young men and women realize also, that what they need to do is really help create a generation that doesn't feel that the world outside wants to kill them, but rather, how do we work together to really revive the best in our culture? The Middle East and North Africa are regions that have witnessed thousands of civilizations. Greek philosophy lived in that part of the world for 1,000 years before it went to Europe. It has a lot to give, and we need to invest in the right people that have a stake. It's their life. It's their world. And what often happens is that the regimes are the first to silence them even before Islam is good to them, because they don't want to reform. They don't want to create a citizen that wants to hold them accountable. They don't want to create a citizen that has freedom of speech. So this is where it really is important that we tie aid, which we give billions of, with real reform, because otherwise their problem is our problem. We are too connected in this day and age. So we have to make a choice.
Thomas Sanderson, one more question before we need to close.
Sure.
So let me ask you if you'd like to comment on what Nadia is saying, and also just any final words with respect to where should we go from here? You know, what lessons have we learned and what do we need to do going forward to both counter the narrative and at the larger level, you know, thwart threats from terrorism, whether ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or others?
Let me begin by making a comment to Nadia's fantastic remarks, and that is when Nadia spoke about educating children, that hints at a thread that runs through so many of the elements of preparing for counterterrorism in the future or counter-radicalization in what we're discussing here today, and that is the failure to plan for the long term, to strategize. We are hyper-reactive. We think about what is happening in the next election cycle and the next funding cycle on Capitol Hill. And there are lots of things that can be brought in, resources brought in, to enable people to get some sense of what is around the corner. On the second part, we could kill or capture every single ISIS and Al-Qaeda member today. Gone, they're done. Every single factor and condition that fomented their rise, enabled them, sustained them, all of those conditions remain in place. Corruption, poor governance, lack of governance, economic marginalization, political, social, and cultural marginalization, radicalization, ignorance, all these things remain in place. Demographic pressures, they will not go away, and a new group will swoop in and manipulate those conditions, and we will have the next ISIS and the next Al-Qaeda. And that's where the long-term planning comes in. You have to get at those conditions that have enabled the rise of these groups and that have sustained these groups. Now, all of them are never going to be vanquished, but nonetheless, with good planning, better funding, you can get at some of these conditions because they remain in place. They are very stubborn, but nonetheless, those conditions remain, and that's what we need to get at, is the multitude of conditions that are the foundation for violent extremism we see today.
And the last word to you, Nadia Awad, that but instead of addressing the shortcomings in the Middle East with authoritarian regimes, I'd like you to perhaps, you know, address some shortcomings here in the West, whether in the United States or even in Europe. We're seeing a backlash from the many refugees coming in, a lot of prejudice, discrimination, greater surveillance, some of which may or may not be really justified and which could produce, again, a backlash and also more extremism. For example, in France. How do you address this?
So 2 points. One is, you know, smartphone penetration in the Middle East and North Africa is at 40%. So in every kid's pocket, there's a smartphone. You can reach them directly. And when they are holding their smartphone in their hand, they can go anywhere they want. So we really have to think, like Tom said, long term. Put content in Arabic, not religious, us deciding what's good, what's bad, but actually skills, ideas, values, things that can really help them become the global citizens they can be. So this is number one. Number two is regarding what we can do here. You know, there are master narratives that extremists use to recruit that, for example, heighten the grievances that we are at war. Everybody wants to attack Islam. So when we actually take action that makes it look like, oh, these master narratives are correct, we only feed the beast. And there are a lot of great examples of communities that have opened their arms to immigrants, and these need to be highlighted. There are a lot of success stories in America. You know, I am a person who really benefited from the American dream. I came with nothing and through meritocracy. So I think it's important to attack these master narratives, both among Western communities that all Muslims are terrorists, etc., but also among immigrant communities here.
I'm afraid, unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guest, Thomas Sanderson, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Nadia Owaydat, Middle East Fellow at New America. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and Encounter was produced right here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
On this edition.